Welcome everyone to this week's edition of the Quantum Gravity Seminar. We're all very pleased to have Wolfgang visiting us here, and he will tell us about the world life algorithm for spitballs.
Thank you, Philipp, and thank you for the invitation and for all of you coming here. So in this talk, I will present my recent work on a proposal for simplicial world line action that should be used for spin foam gravity. And the interesting thing is that the theory is a theory for a discretized manifold, but there is a Hamiltonian and there are local gauge symmetries. And generic solutions of the equations of motion, of these classical equations of motion, represent twisted geometries that appear in the semi-classical limit of loop quantum gravity. And that, I think, makes it interesting for this classical action for loop quantum gravity. I would like to speak about three topics. So first of all, how this action is, how I constructed this action from first principles. Then that there is a Hamiltonian formulation for this discretized theory. And then I will comment and close with relations to other approaches. Let me just go briefly through the motivations. So in the spin foam approach, we try to define transition amplitudes for loop quantum gravity boundary states, which are spin network functions. And the EPRL model is a concrete realization of this idea. And there are interesting results, like the graviton propagator on a fixed four simplex, then the recovery of the Regge action for large spin, and many other things. But of course, the interesting things are the open problems. And they fall more or less in these points. So one big question is how one should recover a continuum formulation, then whether we miss additional secondary constraints related to torsion. This is a point that has often emphasized by Sergei Alexandrov, whether there is an apparent flatness problem around the triangles in the discretization, and whether we have a notion of causality in spin forms. What I want to emphasize is that all of these problems, which appear to be problems just of the quantum theory, can already studied at the classical level. And studying them at the classical level is something much more, much simpler than looking around in the deep quantum amplitudes, what's going wrong. So in other words, what I think what we need is a framework of simplicial gravity with the same field content as loop quantum gravity. Let me explain this a bit in more detail. So a spin foam model assigns amplitudes to the elementary simplicial building blocks in the simplicial complex. So it assigns amplitudes to the two-dimensional phases, which are amplitudes to the vertices and one-dimensional edges. And in the naive semi-classical limit, each of these amplitudes defines an action. And the full spin foam amplitudes are then given in the semi-classical limit, these amplitudes define a spin foam action, which is a sum over the contributions from all the simplicial building blocks. But instead of now starting with a particular spin foam model, we can now ask whether we can just write down such an action with the same field content as loop quantum gravity, and whether this defines a consistent theory of simplicial gravity. And then in a second step, we can then ask to quantize this theory in order to define a spin foam model. So what I'm focusing is more the classical formulation of the spin foam approach. And let me now go into the technical part, namely how I construct this classical action from first principles. What we are following in spin foams is the Blavatsky principle. The Blavatsky principle is just the fact that we can write a general relativity as a constrained topological theory. In fact, the BF action, which I've written down here, just defines the symplectic structure of the theory. So the configuration variable is a S013 connection, and its momentum conjugate is a Lie algebra valued 2 form. Now, this action is topological, but it is interesting for us because it determines the symplectic structure of the theory, and we can get general relativity just by adding the simplicity constraints, tell us that this 2 form field sigma alpha beta is simple, so that there exists a tetrad which defines a 4-dimensional metric such that sigma alpha beta is just E veg E. And now the strategy that I'm following is to just take this action, to discretize it over a simplicial complex, and then to add the simplicity constraints in an appropriate way. And so the first step is therefore to just look at the discretization of this BF action, of the topological action by itself. And what is interesting is that this action, so this is just that this action can be written as a 1-dimensional word line action. And that is just a fact. And the construction goes as follows. So I take the 4-dimensional manifold and introduce a simplicial decomposition. So simplicial building blocks, 4 simplices that are glued among bounding tetrahedra. And each simplex consists of 10 triangles, which build up this 4 simplex. But then it is more useful not to think in this manifold picture, but somehow in the dual picture, where each of these triangles is dual to a 2-dimensional face, which I've pictured here. And every 4 simplex is dual to a vertex, and every tetrahedron is represented here as a 1-dimensional edge. And what is now interesting is that I can discretize the topological action as a 1-dimensional word line action. So what I do is I discretize the BF action as a sum over these 2-dimensional faces, and each of these faces contributes a 1-dimensional integral, which will play the role of the word lines of this model. And the integrand is just a symplectic potential. Why is it a symplectic potential? That is not so difficult to understand. In fact, the BF action just is the symplectic potential of general relativity in a sense. And what you see here is this covariant symplectic potential written in different variables, namely in the spinorial representation of loop quantum gravity. So this was just the introduction. Yes, so I will explain this in the next slides, what these variables are in the next couple of slides. So the construction goes as follows. And then I will also explain what these variables are. So first of all, I start with the 4-dimensional BF action, which is just a 2 form contracted with the curvature. And the discretization is a kind of point splitting procedure where I split this 4-dimensional integral into 2-dimensional integral. Such that this 2 form, which plays the role of the momentum variable, is integrated over triangles, while the curvature tensor is integrated over the dual surfaces, which are the faces in the discretization. And to maintain gauge invariance, this contraction requires additional holonomies, which I've written here, that map all indices into a common frame. So here, what you see here is just this integral. So that is the integral of this momentum variable, which is a 2 form, over a triangle in the discretization. And all indices are mapped into a frame at the boundary of the 2-dimensional surface. And for the curvature part. So this line is just the first part in this discretization, while the curvature is integrated over the dual surface. So it's not integrated over the triangle, but the two-dimensional surface dual to this triangle. And to write this integral in a covariant form, I employ the non-abelian Stokes theorem, which just tells me that the curvature in this plane, in this two-dimensional surface, which is spanned by dt and dz, that the integral of this two form can be written as a derivative of a holonomy along this line. This is in fact just the simple fact that if you have a 1D holonomy and you look how this parallel transport changes as you deform this path, this gives you the curvature in this along this infinite two-dimensional surface. And if I now bring these two pieces together, I can write the contribution to the topological action coming from a phase F as this one-dimensional integral over the boundary of the phase. And so this 4D integral has turned just into a 1D integral over the boundary of these simplicial building blocks. That is somehow the key step in this discretization. And let me explain this maybe a bit more because it's the crucial step. So there are the triangles, which are dual to two-dimensional surfaces, F. And what I introduce is a holonomy from the boundary of this phase into the center of this phase. And by employing the non-abelian Stokes theorem, I can show that the covariant differential of this holonomy into the direction of this edge gives the curvature tensor in this infinitesimal 2D surface. And if I then integrate this, I get this formula, which is just an. And then I've written this action in this binorial representation, which is just useful for us because it simplifies several calculations. So what I do is I diagonalize this flux just by a pair of spinors, and then I can use these spinors also to parametrize the holonomy. And if I bring everything together, I arrive at this simple expression where there is an additional constraint which reduces these spinors again to holonomy flux variables. And now this BF, the contribution to the BF action coming from a single phase is just reduced to this covariant symplectic potential for these spinors living on this one-dimensional phase. Yes. Yes. I should have explained that better. So a holonomy is connects two points in the manifold, and to parametrize it by spinors, I need a basis in C2. And there is one attached to the boundary, which I call pi and omega. And there is a different basis attached to the center of the phase, which I call pi tilde and omega tilde. So these are two frames at two points. And the transformation that maps one into the other is exactly the holonomy between the two. So what we now need to do, the big D, which appears here, is so this is the holonomy of a connection, and the big D is just the covariant derivative with respect to this connection. So the formula that I have is H is so this the boundary of this phase is a 1D path which can be parametrized by some by a 1D coordinate T. So different values of T determine different points on this boundary. And for each of these, for each value of T, I have a holonomy into the center of the of this phase. So this holonomy depends on T. And I can look at the covariant differential of this holonomy, and this gives me the curvature by the thanks to the non-abelian Stokes theorem. So this is so the action depends on four elements: two twisters, so pi and omega defines one of them, pi tilde omega tilde the other pair. Both of them parametrize both the holonomy and the momentum variable, the flux. The Lagrange multiplier theta reduces these spinors to the original holonomy flux variables, and this one-dimensional connection is what appears in this covariant derivative. Then the next step, so this is a way to write the BF action as a one-dimensional action over the boundary of each phase. And the next step is to add the simplicity constraints, which reduce this one-dimensional, which reduce the BF action to an action for general relativity. And what I use are the linear simplicity, so in linear simplicity constraints. So instead of these quadratic simplicity constraints, I use the linear constraints, which say that for every tetrahedron in the discretization, there shall exist a four vector n alpha e, so an internal future-oriented four vector, such that it annihilates the flux through any triangle in the tetrahedron. And if I write these constraints, which are three equations for each triangle, in terms of the spinors, I get these two constraints. And now the idea is to add them to the action. And what happens is that here, so that is the that is just the origin, so the first line is just the BF action, while the second line are just these additional constraints that break the topological symmetries of BF theory. And notice also that by adding these simplicity constraints, I can reduce this SL2C derivative by an SU2 connection, which turns out to be just the Ashtekar-Barbero connection. But now comes the really crucial point of this of the entire construction. What I've done here is I have introduced, so this action depends now on these spinors, which are the which parameterize the original BF degrees of freedom, Lagrange multipliers that impose constraints, the connection. But now there's this additional element, this time norm, this four normal that determines the normal of every tetrahedron. And there's the problem now, the conceptual problem is now that this variable is not dynamical. So there's nothing in this action that determines the dependence of this variable as we, the dependence of this variable in T, how this variable changes along these one-dimensional edges. And as far as I, or what I think is that the failure to define a dynamic for these variables is somehow at the heart of many problems that we have in spin forms. For instance, the flatness issue that has been pointed out by Frank Hellman and Wojtek Kaminski and Valentin Bonsom is, I think, ultimately related to the fact that these normals appear not as dynamical variables in the action. So how could one introduce, or what would be a way to make these normals? Why this is the? Yeah. So it is. So, for instance, if you take this action, you would also have to take variations with respect to n, which then so maybe the easiest way to see the issue is this: if you the fact that there are no dynamics for this normal imply that all different or even adjacent phases in the discretizations are uncoupled, or the only part in the Hamiltonian that couples adjacent phases is just the Gauss constraint. And this.
I'm confused here because you don't put the label. Here it's per phase or it's per edge? Because something depends on the phase.
So this depends. These variables all depend per phase, while this depends on the edge. So this is a sign. Yes.
So that can be.
If I do the Hamiltonian analysis for this action, what turns out is that this constraint is second class, such that the Lagrange multiplier in front of it vanishes. So it is true that this term would generate a coupling, but it just vanishes because it's second class. And then all the adjacent phases decouple. That is true. That is exactly what I said, that the only piece, the only term in the action that couples adjacent phases is the Gauss law, which comes indeed from the variation of the connection hiding in this covariant derivative. You mean these two? They are just the simplest. No. This actually does. I said that if you do the constraint analysis, this Lagrange multiplier is constrained to vanish. So you don't. Set is just a set. It depends on F, because it's a Lagrange multiplier for every phase in the triangulation. It is just something that I mean I tried many things, and for just the action written like this, I recover this issue that has been pointed out by these three people already on the classical level, not on the quantum theory. So out of that I concluded that one should modify the action in a consistent way. And this would be now the next thing I would like to talk about. So what I would like to say is that one should add a term in the action that determines this the dynamics for these normals. So, but this I cannot just define out of the blue air. I have to any proposal for the dynamics must be consistent with the geometric interpretation of these normals. In fact, if I weight these normals by the volume of the tetrahedron, then they must obey a closure constraint, which is just the which just reflects the geometricity of the four simplex. So if you four simplex consists of five tetrahedra, and the geometricity of the four simplex is coded in this equation that tells us that the sum of all these of all these volume weighted normals must sum up to zero if they are oriented properly. So or what this is saying, so in 3D we have the Gauss law that tells us that for any tetrahedron the sum over the normals times the area of the faces must be zero. So this is a tetrahedron, and that is the area of a tetrahedron times the normal of each face. The sum of all of them must sum up to zero. In four dimensions, this generalizes just to the four-dimensional closure constraint that tells us, that gives us this equation. And now, this is just like a momentum conservation law that tells us that if we orient all of these normals, if we demand that all of these normals are future oriented, then the incoming edges, the sum over all incoming momenta must be the same of all outgoing momenta. So these normals of the tetrahedra just behave like momenta in a sense. And which brings me to the following proposal. So instead of using the normals, which are normalized to one, I replace these variables by momentum variables, which are just multiplied by the volume of the tetrahedron. So for each tetrahedron, I have this four vector. And now I just add a term to the action which determines the dynamics of this variable. The first term is just a symplectic potential that tells me that this piece have a conjugate momentum, which I call x. And the second piece in this action is just a constraint that tells me that these normals are normalized such that they give the volume of the tetrahedron. And
here you choose p to be equal to volume. In general, it could be proportional. Right? So I'm asking that because of the dimension. Your volume is dimensionless.
Yes. That is so.
If you really want to say momenta, don't you want to put some G Newton or some conversion factor?
Yeah. So what I
so that the previous limit where this volume is infinite just comes from putting this conversion. Here you have a momenta equal to length to the cube, or to the.
Yes, so this should have dimensions 1 over length, while this has length to the 3. So I would need a dimensionful quantity. That is right. But. Or the cosmological. Yeah, that is right. I haven't done that, or I haven't done that just to make these equations more more transparent. So what I would have needed here are just additional constants that fix these dimensions. But for the moment, I just think of these of each terms of these of the action just to have. To be measured in terms of Planck units, which is the same as to say that there are the appropriate constants in front of each of these terms.
But I'm saying that because of the previous limit. And in the previous limit, we essentially recover in the limit where one of these conversion factors goes to 0 or infinity.
Yeah, that is.
Is it 0 or infinity?
Which
suppose I put the alpha.
I see.
Alpha going to infinity? Infinite mass?
So the
usually, you know, if you have an infinite mass, you don't have any kinetic term.
Yeah, it would correspond to an infinite mass limit where this dynamics becomes trivial. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, thanks for pointing this out. So, by adding this term, we now need additional term. So to make this action functional differentiable, I need additional terms at the vertices. And this additional term is just a kind of gluing condition. And that tells me that all these, that all these vertices glue together in a point in this auxiliary X space. So in fact, this X space turns into an auxiliary manifold where these edges are embedded. And this additional constraint or this additional term in the action that I need to make the action functional differentiable just tells me that these vertices represent points in this auxiliary X space, so that the action happens at the point, which is in fact exactly. So that the construction of this action follows in fact exactly the construction of the relative locality actions, which is also an action in where just this is just inverted, but. Yes. Yeah, that is a very good question, and in fact, so I don't know what the analog of this action in the continuum is, but what I would expect is that it's something similar to what Stefan Gielen and Daniele Oriti proposed a while ago, where they wrote down a Plebansky-like action with an additional time normals, so normals. I can write this down, but all what I want to say is that there are formulations of general relativity where there are variables like these p alphas. And
I guess the question behind that, and I love that because but is, okay, what problem am I solving when I'm at, so here I'm adding more degrees of freedom. What is it that I'm, it's kind of really, because what am I, so it's nice because all the things is in, but you know, all the locality is in, but what am I solving?
So,
you know, despite the beauty of the mathematical structure and the need of the locality, is it, what question is answering to the relevance?
So, the goal of this entire construction is to have a classical framework from which I can then build the quantum theory. Now this X space, this additional auxiliary space, doesn't exist in, we don't know it in general relativity. In fact, my suspicion is that the continuum limit would correspond as you mentioned, in fact, a limit of infinite mass where this X space somehow shrinks to a point, and the dynamics in X is just drops out of the equations of motion.
What is the opposite limit, the massless limit?
Mm-hmm. Ah, yeah, that is so the opposite limit. If we would quantize this, then the opposite limit would be a limit where the mass is sent to zero. So the volume of each of these simplicial building blocks is sent to zero, and this would now represent a deep quantum regime where X is dominant, where these particles can propagate over a very long distance. But what we will see is that this or what I also wanted to say is that this Hamiltonian, that this additional term in the action changes the dynamics. In fact, if we look at these edges, then we can associate a tetrahedron to these edges. But now this additional term creates a shear such that these tetrahedra change their shape if we go forward along this one-dimensional time, which is exactly how twisted geometries appear in this framework. If we now send the mass to zero, so these tetrahedra become small, and this edge becomes longer and longer, and these particles start twisting faster and faster. So this becomes more and more different than Regge calculus, where in a Regge geometry, there would be no twisting. Everything each tetrahedron would just stay the same, and everything would glue consistently together, which is true if we make these tetrahedra heavier and heavier, or larger, or in spin foam language to go to a large J limit. While if we make them light, this is a low J limit, so a deep quantum regime where these tetrahedra just change their shape rapidly. So this would be the deep quantum regime. And the idea would be that this would then be more accessible to a perturbative analysis, while the Regge limit would be a non-perturbative regime where there are many many interactions.
So that's the answer to my previous question. But it's sort of the guidance in the picture that now there's a sense in which the geometry's connector, which is twisting, fits perfectly because now there's time for them to twist.
Yes. In fact, if one studies the standard amplitudes, one gets on the saddle point no twisting, which is in stark contrast to what we have on the boundary states, where a generic configuration is a twisted geometry. And there is a priori no reason why this should be suppressed. And this provides a mechanism how this would work. So I think I run out of time.
No, you're
there for 20
more minutes.
Ah, okay. Ah, right. It's not. Yeah, right. I was confused. Okay, that's good. So now the total action, this is somehow the summary, consists of three pieces. The first piece is just what we always have is just the usual spin foam piece. In fact, if I would quantize just this, I would get the EPRL model. What I now say is that we need two additional terms that determine the dynamics of these additional variables that we have introduced by adding the simplicity constraints. And what I'm saying is that these additional variables behave like momentum variables of additional particles propagating in an auxiliary X space. And then there's an additional term which imposes, in fact, locality, that each of these vertices sits at one point in the auxiliary X space. Now, let me say something more. Now I have defined this action, and now we can just look at the equations of motion and see which kind of geometries, whether solutions of the equations of motion have a geometric interpretation. So the first observation is that the action that I've written down is a Hamiltonian action. So it's an action in phase space. So I can immediately write down Poisson brackets and the Hamiltonian, which is just the sum over constraints. So this is the usual Gauss law. These are the simplicity constraints. These are just the constraints that reduce spinners to holonomy flux variables, and that's in fact the new term. That is just this Marshall condition that imposes this condition that these momenta have a geometric interpretation in terms of the volume of each tetrahedron. Now I can do the constraint analysis, and what I find is that some constraints are second class, in fact just these, and all the others are first class constraint. And the crucial point is that there are no secondary constraints, which has often been claimed that spin forms would miss additional secondary constraints, which I don't see here. But the interesting part is how I get twisted geometries, how I get a geometric interpretation for these variables. So general relativity is all about geometry. So how do I see geometry in this framework? So what I just have to do is to solve the constraints. So first of all, there are the simplicity constraints. And they tell me that each of these triangles define planes in Minkowski space, so that these two forms are simple such that they define planes. Then the next constraint is the Gauss constraint. And the Gauss constraint just tells me that these planes sum up to form, that they close to form a tetrahedron. And now I can reconstruct a tetrahedron which lives in the space orthogonal to this momentum. And now I can ask, how does this tetrahedron evolve as I move forward as I move along this edge? And what happens is that the crucial point, the crucial term, is just this volume term. And this has, in fact, been studied already by Bianchi and Hal Haggard, and they have found that the Hamiltonian vector field of the volume functional, which is just this triple product of three fluxes in the tetrahedron, creates a shear. So it preserves the volume but changes the shape, which means that each of these triangles in the discretization that we are not in a Recce framework. In a Recce framework, this would be a rigid triangle which has where each of these edge lengths are well defined. While here, there's a shear which deforms this tetrahedron such that these edge lengths are not anymore globally defined, which gives us a twisted geometry. How much do I still have? So I would like to close with some applications to other approaches. So first of all, I don't want to scare you, but now this is all so the action is already in Hamiltonian form. So I can easily quantize everything. So the P, for instance, is just minus I d over d xa as an operator, and similarly for the spinners. And if I then quantize the constraints, they just become these differential operators. And if I solve them, and here I just wrote the solution for one triangle, I get the following wave function for a triangle in the discretization. And the nice thing is that this is just loop quantum gravity. In fact, if I construct the area operator up to the ordering, this just reproduces exactly what we have in loop quantum gravity. So the quantization of the instantaneous phase space corresponding to a tetrahedron is exactly the Hilbert space, the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. And what is also nice is that I have now a proposal how to add matter, because this has always been the problem in spin forms, so that it was, for instance, not very clear how to add just a massless scalar field. And I'm working with Francesca Vidotto to solve this. In fact, what we do is we just start from the meta action for a massless scalar field. If you do a 3+1 split, I get the following action. And now I discretize it and just add it to this simplicial action that I already have. So the first piece, the symplectic potential, is simple. The difficult thing is to add this term to the spin form action. But what allows me to add this to the action is that there is this Laplace function. In fact, the Laplace function that I, this n, this Lagrange multiplier that I have in this edge action has exactly the same dimensions as this Laplace function. It has, in fact, dimensions of an inverse density, which allows me to discretize this piece and just add it to this discretized action. And this would give a model for just scalar matter propagating on a spin form discretization. And this I'm now starting with Francesca. This I want just to say that this action formalism opens a door to, for instance, add meta degrees of freedom to these to spin forms. Then another interesting observation is that the action defines implicitly an action for an for causal sets, which has been pointed out by Marina Cortes and Lee Smolin. In fact, this is easy to see. Every edge in the discretization is now oriented because it carries a future-oriented momentum variable p. So we can just call the initial. So we identify, or what they do is to identify each vertex with an event, and say that two neighboring vertices sharing an edge are causally ordered if one is just the initial point and the other one the final point with respect to this time orientation. And this would give, and this defines a model of, yes, but the point is that So this auxiliary space comes with a natural metric, which is the Lorentz metric in internal space, which defines time direction in internal space. That is, which is just always. So locally, yes. In momentum space.
Momentum space, which is in internal space. Where here is the same. Well, you have this metric in internal space and you have friends. So fully you have a curve matrix.
Yeah. Now in fact I'm already ready to conclude. So the key insight here is that I now have a dictionary. So between two sides. So one is the spin form description of simplicial gravity, and the other one is a dual picture, which is a particle picture. And in this, according to this dictionary, each of the four syntheses represents an interaction vertex for these particles. And each tetrahedron is one of these particles. And the three volume of each tetrahedron in the simplicial decomposition just plays the role of a mass for these particles. And but these particles also carry internal degrees of freedom, internal SU2 degrees of freedom, which correspond to the tetrahedral shapes of this particle. And the vanishing of torsion is in fact just the momentum conservation law at this vertex. And now I can come back to your question, in fact. Now that we can study two different limits. One limit is where the internal degrees of freedom are getting large. So the spin is getting large. So which corresponds to an ultraviolet limit in the corresponding group field theory variables. But large spins means large volume, which means that this interaction distance, which is more or less given by which scales as a Compton wavelength, like 1 over volume, which becomes mass, becomes small. So that means that these distances are short, which means that there's no much room for twisting between neighboring vertices, which means that we are in a Regge-like framework, which just so that we are in good sort of while the
low curvature.
Exactly low. While the other limit, which corresponds to small spins, correspond to light particles, which means that these distances become longer and longer, which means that these particles change shape more and more rapidly, which means high curvature, and which means that we're in a deep quantum regime. And this would be something important to further study. And I've just started to think about this with Aldo and Laurent. So now I can conclude already. So I have presented, so first of all, I've defined action for spin forms. And this action is just a word line integral over the entire system of edges appearing in the simplicial decomposition. This also may also introduce a notion of causality, because each of these edges are oriented, and we can now distinguish future pointing from past pointing edges, which led to a proposal for energetic causal set. Now, the free Hamiltonian along these edges generates a twist. So this is a classical framework that generates twisted geometries, which shows that it's possible that twisted geometries just appear in the semi-classical limit of the corresponding quantum theory. Then the action is already in a Hamiltonian form, which means that the canonical quantization of this free evolution is straightforward and just reproduces the quantum geometries of loop quantum gravity. And what is interesting, what I find most intriguing, is this emerging duality that appears, that every tetrahedron represents a massive particle with some internal SU2 degrees of internal SU2n degrees of freedom, and every particle carries a conserved momentum, which represents not mass, but the volume of the tetrahedron. Thank you for your attention.
Two related questions. First of all, if you deform the momentum conservation law at the vertex a la relative locality, would that correspond to having simplicities embedded in a curved space or something like that? That corresponds, you said, to the consistency relation between faces and areas and normals.
What do you mean?
So what I would expect is
conservation law of the momentum.
So what I argued is that so this conservation law represents torsion, because torsion is just a, actually I have a slide for this, which I dropped. Let me just go to this, so here. So torsion means that the exterior covariant derivative of the tetrad vanishes. And out of this, it follows that also this, the exterior derivative of this tree form vanishes. And if I integrate this, this just gives me this conservation law for this momenta, which are just these integrals.
Just a small point, does the duplication go backwards?
This does not yet imply this. This does not yet. Wait a second.
I would guess it does the same number of equations. Anyway, sorry to distract you. It is the same number of equations.
Is it? Because there are still four indices. While here, this is a four form, so there's only
it's
one.
Fewer equations, you're right.
So these are less equations than this. What did I want to add? So, for instance, if you add a fermion, then you would get here a current on the right-hand side. And then you would have no any longer this closure. So I would expect that the addition of fermions breaks this dual momentum conservation law, which could then lead to something like...
Maybe that affects, because here you're speaking in the real geometry sense, right? Then
yes.
There's this pre-geometric language in which you embed your synthesis in a space. And so fermions correspond to the formations of the conservation. That's really fascinating. Another question related to this is, can you deform the group to SU cubed too?
For instance, if I had a cosmology constant, I would expect so, but I have not studied this.
Does that change in some way the particle model?
I would expect that then I would also have to change this auxiliary space. That this should then
the X
space. That this should then also carry a cosmological constant. I would expect.
So it would be a sphere.
So one question is that Simone and
Fabio.
They looked at the primary simplicity constraints within the F Hamiltonian, and they found secondary constraints. And I understand that your understanding of Hamiltonian is different, which actually I would like you more to comment on. But
yes. So it is
so confusing if you say that everything is already in Hamiltonian, but they at least confirmed that there are secondary simplicity constraints. And they are more in a standard approach where it's more reliable that the standard approach of canonical analysis. So I would rather believe in these results as.
Yes, I
you
so
were
I,
stating,
I,
oh, I don't have secondary simplicity.
So
constraints.
I, yeah, it's.
can I ask a question of the question?
Can I just?
No, you go first, because you may be going to say what I'm.
Okay, so what did I want? What they use as a Hamiltonian is, as you say, a BF type of constraint that the curvature around any loop in three space. Should vanish. So the holonomy around the loop should be just the identity. And then they claim that they find secondary constraints. But by looking at the paper, I think they would also get more higher order constraints, tertiary and quaternary constraints. So I don't find their analysis very very profound.
No, but it's a simple, I mean, they have more reasons, they give more reasons that this result could also hold if you change the constraint. And apart from that, there's a simple reason that you get secondary simplicity constraints, which is geometrical. Which, you know, that the connection has to be also simple to actually preserve the simplicity of the fluxes.
So what I would like to say is that the question whether there are secondary constraints or not, this has in fact not a geometrical meaning. This is just something that comes.
No, it has a geometrical meaning.
Let me just finish.
I disagree because.
No, what I just want to say is that one uses a different Hamiltonian formalism, for instance. Constraints that turn out to be first class may not be of first class in a different formalism. And this is, I think, what I see here. In fact, what one should ask is so what is the role of the secondary constraints in the continuum formalism? They just represent the vanishing of torsion, in fact. Because they tell us, so if you work with complex Ashtekar variables, they tell us that A plus A dagger is 2 gamma IA, so the Levi-Civitar connection corresponding to the tetra. And this is what you are asking for. Where is this condition hiding in spin forms? But this is just another way to say that the connection is torsion-free. And what I have added here at the vertices is an additional conservation law which is not present in the usual spin form approach. And what I have also told you is that this additional conservation law has the interpretation of the vanishing of torsion. So in a sense,
it's one component of the torsion.
Okay. Yes, there are also other components which, for instance, the Gauss law by itself, it represents also the vanishing of torsion. Another component of the four-dimensional torsion equation. So all what I want to say is that just because here there are no secondary constraints doesn't mean that the physical content of the secondary constraints is not present in this formalism. The physical content or the geometric content of the secondary constraints is the vanishing of torsion, and this I have implemented here as the geometricity of the whole simplex. But also,
you could go even further and say the simplicity constraint even involves the vanishing of twisting.
I don't see why this is.
There are certain papers which show this. As you know.
Well, there are also certain papers which claim the opposite, like, you know, what I did with Carlo and Francesca.
This was definitely not showing that the secondary simplicity constraints don't impose that. You showed that the Levi-Civitar connection exists, which is fine. But
which shows that twisting is something different as torsion.
But you didn't show that the torsion was automatically vanishing.
Yeah, I think we just disagree on this point.
Right, are there any other questions?
Yeah.
Okay,
Ali wanted to say something.
No, my was just a trivial technical point as to whether there's a difference between the secondary constraints for the quadratic form of simplicity conditions or the linear form of simplicity.
Oh,
awesome. I guess you did. You answered it. My question was whether it might be that you were addressing quadratic secondary constraints, quadratic simplicity constraints, and the issue of the secondary constraints. And he has a formalism which is linear simplicity constraints.
Oh, yeah, so linear simplicity are well related to the reality conditions. And so on the reality conditions, the secondary simplicity constraints are just the reality conditions on A.
Good.
And the linear formulation is on A. Whereas in quadratic, I don't know, it's not. So the relation between reality conditions and simplicity constraints is much nicer than the for the linear formulation.
Yes, in the continuum.
Yeah, even in the discrete, which we have shown with Jimmy, for instance. We have a discrete version of this.
Well, so Bianca, are you claiming that this formalism that Wolfgang presented is inconsistent or incomplete or
no? I'm a bit not very happy that that at some point it was pointed out that my historical understanding is that for a long time Peter claimed that spin forms are like Gretchen. And then Jimmy and me found out they are not like Reggie, but there's a much larger space. And then half of the people were saying, oh, we always knew that. The other half of the people were surprised. And one guy was saying it doesn't matter at all or whatever. But
I was still in the kindergarten.
In 2008.
Physics kindergarten.
And then, then loop quantum gravity geometries were called twisted geometries, which is fine, and it was always said twisted geometries are so much better than Ratchet geometries, but so far I haven't seen one convincing proposal which says this is the dynamics for twisted geometries.
But this is actually a proposal.
It is a proposal. I don't find it 100% convincing because it's not very clear. I mean, from the beginning, with this finding, okay, we have an enlarged space. The main question is, if you really want to regain magic gravity, there at least should be some way that, for instance, magic gravity get preserved by the dynamics. You know, that if you start maybe with twisted or the twisted, this twisting doesn't play a big role or something.
But there is a mechanism how...
it would be nice to see that in detail and to have these...
This is what I'm studying.
But I'm not convinced yet.
That's
my opinion on what I usually require in terms of being convinced. Might be that's my personal case.
For sure.
And usually in discussions, I only hear, it's very old-fashioned, but I haven't really been convinced yet that there is a really good proposal for the dynamics of twisted geometries. Even a geometric interpretation for twisted geometries, when we are discussing this Wolfgang, but it's not completely clear yet. What is actually the covariant geometric interpretation of twisted geometries? And
in the continuum of this?
Because these things are all in the discrete. It's even not very clear what the continuum analog of twisted geometry should correspond to, except that it's a continuum loop quantum gravity space. But then there's this funny claim by Thomas. That's the point which I don't understand completely, because it's basically loop quantum gravity claims you start this EDM, and take EDM and discretize it in some standard way, kind of something like batching. And then the claim is, okay, we start with EDM, we actually only add a gauge group, and then I end up with twisted geometries, which is much bigger than EDM. So there's lots of non-commuting things.
No, it's just not the metric formulation.
It's not the metric formulation.
It's a connection formulation
there's a huge extension, which also, because we had hints, might have something to do with the general sectors.
But what you just said is in fact the strongest hint that twisted geometries should not be reduced by additional constraints, because as you said, the construction of the Hilbert space as Thomas Thiemann does it is just by starting from ADM, where there are no additional constraints to begin with. Then he introduces a canonical transformation which leads to the Arsteker very
no, but there's a point, yeah, but then you would expect that you get roughly the same result, but you get something which is twisted geometry, which is a huge extension to normal geometry. So I just don't buy the standard sentence, all twisted geometries are so much better than matching geometries without any additional clarification of certain issues.
Okay, I have the feeling we're not going to resolve it at this moment. Does anybody want to add anything to this? Any more questions? Not then, let's thank Wolfgang again.